We were going to hit the special study, but real quick before that, I want to talk about something that came up in my reading, which is your meeting with a specialist named David Jackson at Amex.
I mentioned before, I think, that although there was a tremendous amount of corruption on the American Stock Exchange, I really didn't want to leave the impression that it was all black. It wasn't. And there were some people on the exchange who were entirely honorable in their business dealings and deeply disturbed about what they had observed on the exchange. And foremost was David Jackson, who had actually in early years been a chairman, of the exchange. Jackson was particularly well known and was the subject of a New Yorker article some years earlier when the tabloid radio broadcaster Walter Winchell had touted a oil stock called Pantopec. Jackson, as specialist in that stock the next morning, was faced with a huge, huge influx of buy orders, which under ordinary circumstances would send the stock through the stratosphere. Jackson believed it to be his responsibility as specialist and the obligation of a specialist to maintain a fair and orderly market. I think shorted something like 300,000 shares. I may be wrong, but he went short a huge amount of shares to prevent the market from running away and just increasing moderately. This, of course, was an enormous risk to himself, since if the stock went up, he'd have to buy it back and cover. The old Wall Street jingle goes, he that sells what isn't his'n buys it back or goes to prison.
Right.
Jackson was well known for that, and he lived up to his reputation all the time I dealt with him. Unfortunately, at the beginning of the Amex investigation, one of the investigators had really got into an unpleasant conversation with Jackson, because he couldn't believe there was anybody honest on the American Stock Exchange, and really hounded him. And we got a call from Senator Javits' office, to whom Jackson had complained of his treatment. And Ralph got the call and was quite upset with it, because we had really formed a view that Jackson was not only an honorable man, but looked upon him as an ally in the efforts to reform the exchange. And Ralph sent me up to New York, and I spent an afternoon with Jackson, and I managed to convince him that just as not everybody in the Amex was bad, not everybody at the SEC was a bad guy.
Smoothing some ruffled feathers.
Yeah, we became quite friendly thereafter.
Well, I want to move into the special study. And you discussed the fact that it's got this quasi-independent status. That was one of the ideas. And Milton Cohen, was he brought in from the outside?
Yes. Milton had been, much earlier in his career, director of the Public Utility Division, the Division of Corporate Regulation, when that had its moment in the sun, Now, of course, the statute's been repealed this last year, I guess, but the rationalizing of the public utility holding companies was considered a major operation of the SEC, and I think Milton was the second director of that division. And I think that's where he first met Bill Carey. That's obviously in Milton's transcript of his oral history. But, in any event, he was Bill Carey's choice as director. And he then selected staff. Ralph became an associate director of the special study. Milton divided the staff functionally. While there was a general counsel, Dick Paul, right below that, there were a series of project chiefs. I think there were seven or eight of us. Six or seven. And we had various projects. The study was divided into a series of projects. Mine were basically the New York Stock Exchange and its trading operations, the floor activities on the New York Stock Exchange, and commission rates fell under that.
Were these assigned to you? Or was it the sort of thing where you sort of divvy things up depending on what your interest was?
Ralph made these, Ralph with Milton made the assignments, but Ralph was, of the people that came from the commission staff, Ralph knew what their interest and what their strong points were. And, Milton pretty much just ratified it. And we then each had some people working for us and some people, technical specialists working in common. So if you needed economic or statistical assistance, etc.
On call as needed.
Yeah, it was in the, okay. Was in the group. And in my area, I divided the exchange operations into specialists, odd lot dealing, floor traders, commission rates. Those were the major subgroups that I was responsible for. I ended up writing the specialists section, parts of the floor trading section, just a little bit of the odd lot section, and some but not much of the commission rate section, but they were all under my immediate supervision. And that's how we went about our duties. At first, I also had financial PR under my supervision because we had found in the Amex investigation the first use of PR that we knew about to manipulate stock prices, put it that way. There was a stock operator by the name of, and businessman in New York, who was also a quintessential New York character, named Jerry Finkelstein. And he had been a partner of Tex McCrary, who was a publicist, and engaged in some financial PR operations. Finkelstein later controlled four or five Amex companies, which were then, put parenthesis around, clients of Gilgan Will. And we became interested in what with us was new, that how public relations were being used as part of the scheme to manipulate the prices of these stocks. The leading journalist, columnist in finance in New York was a columnist on the Journal American, the old Hearst outlet in New York. Also Benjamin Gould, no relationship to the Milton Gould, the lawyer. And so he would write a financial column for years and years and years, which was very Wall Street oriented. And my classmate on the staff, Norm Poser, and I, during the course of the Amex investigation, went to the morgue of the Journal American and asked if we identified ourselves, of course, and asked for columns that had to do with specific companies on the American Stock Exchange. And the fellow that ran the morgue of the Journal American, who had obviously been there for many, many years, and had a very rich brogue, I recall, said to us, smiled, said to us, "Oh, after old Jerry Finkelstein, are you?"
It wasn't a big secret, I guess.
Not when he had the names of the companies. He knew, he knew just what we were up to. In any event, since I had more on my plate, I could handle, that was broken off, and Norm ran that that project. And
so your job was to essentially keep these four different investigations.
Yeah, I headed up these four investigations. Probably under other circumstances, the odd lot investigation would have gotten much more publicity, both on what was uncovered and on what happened as a result of this special study investigation. Without going into any detail if the odd lot system worked, it can only be described as bizarre. There were two firms, Carlyle and Jacqueline, and DeCoppett and DeRemus, who essentially split the odd lot business between them. And just to take a minute, this becomes important for other reasons. The way it worked was if you bought an odd lot of stock, it did not get subjected to the normal exchange market-making process. It didn't go to the specialist post where, you know, there'd be a broker to buy and a broker to sell. The order went to one of these two firms, and they had what they would call associate brokers, who were members of the exchange, who stood at the specialist post. And when AT&T sold at 40, or whatever price, they would have all these odd lot orders, and they would execute the odd lot orders at 40, plus or minus. And the plus or minus would be, I picked 40 as a bad number, let's say the stock sold at 41. If you were selling an odd lot, you were selling your 50 shares of American Telephone, what you would get would be 39 3/4, they would charge you a quarter. If you were buying an odd lot, you would pay 41 3/4. 41 1/2. 40 was the break point. And because of over 40, the charge was a half, I believe, and under 40, the charge was a quarter. I may be wrong, but it's in the report. And of course, with the flow of odd lots being such, on both sides, the firms really did not have to take any large positions, because they were essentially matching their own, the buy and sell order that they had. Now, theoretically, these two firms were in competition with each other. Vieta was a very structured, very mannered competition that the major firms, brokerage firms, would switch from one to the other on prearranged times. And when Merrill Lynch switched one to the other, six firms had to switch the other way to keep the business relatively even between these firms. By the way, the odd lot customer not only paid this odd lot differential, but you paid a normal stock exchange commission to the broker to whom you had given your order. We found that, in fact, what was going on was the prices being charged were arrived at an agreement between the two firms. The activity was totally collusive between them, and that as far as the reasonableness of the charges, what was going on is that these firms were financing other all kinds of other services for exchange members. If you wanted to open a branch office in Oshkosh, you would go to one of these firms and they would provide the architect, architectural plans, construction management, etc. They were busy providing all kinds of services to the other stock exchange firms. As we got further and further into the activity, it became more and more sort of Alice in Wonderland, the kind of things that occurred to anyone with their head screwed on right, that the function being performed was essentially mechanical. And the risk being taken by these firms were minimal. As a matter of fact, they pretty much would end each day with a zero position in every stock, because they would buy or sell enough at the very end of the day just to be able to go home and sleep in a zero neutral position. We got wind very early. And when I say got wind, let me again diverge for a couple of seconds to make another point. And that is, a lot of what we did in the special study were as a result of creating relationships with a lot of people on Wall Street. And I think over the years, that's what the commission on the regulatory side has failed to do. You can't do it all based on papers that are busy filed with the reports filed with the commission. A, you lose a feel for what's going on, and B, you really lose a tremendous opportunity to get ahead of the curve. Be several people on the street who can see developing problems or changes, just changes, which the commission should be aware of. And I think that one of the legacies we tried to leave was to kind of institutionalize that among our successors, but it atrophied. Why, I don't know. But it was a tremendous tool for us in the special study. It was just a web of connections which we made on the street. David Jackson was one of them.
How hard would it have been to make these connections? Because after all, there's something of a wall or a no man's land between the SEC and the industry.
Well, not really as hard as you think, because after all, a lot of what you're doing is not controversial. I mean, if there's no problem, there's nothing at all that inhibits you from just talking about what's going on the street. People like to talk about their businesses.
Right.
The contacts are can be conducted on a highly informal basis. Again, you have to obviously know when you're wandering into an area that may involve some conflicts of interest, or you don't want to mislead the fellow you're talking to. He may be in trouble, so you don't pursue that kind of thing. But everybody on Wall Street knows everybody else's business. Not quite. As a matter of fact, I mentioned the architectural services that the firms are paying for.
Yeah.
In one of my Q&As with one of the elder statesmen on Wall Street, I asked him if he thought it was appropriate for the odd law firms to be financing these activities essentially on the backs of odd lot customers. And he looked at me and said, I've been on Wall Street for 50 years, and one thing I know is you can never know who the hell's paying for what.
Well, the odd lots investigation, interesting as it is, and there's, you know, with clear collusion, I guess as far as proportion of business, that's still something off to the side.
Well, yes, it is off to the side a little bit. But they control 10% of the seats on the stock exchanges.
That's a pretty respectable number.
And just to complete it, what we found was in the files of the firms documents which show that in 1957, the exchange had retained the consulting firm of Abasco and Company to study the floor operations of the exchange from a space point of view. They were running out of space. The first thing Abasco recommended was, do you really need all these odd lot fellows standing around the floor of the exchange? Why not get rid of them and put in an adding machine? You didn't even need a computer. A lot of this could have been done with the adding machines of the day. Well, the campaign that the odd lot firms ran against the Abasco report is very, very illuminating. And it's all in the special study report. Let's spread a rumor that if the Abasco report is adopted, there will be 100 seats dumped on the exchange.
The value of yours will go down.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, but the conclusion of it was that at the end of the study, it was clear that the odd-lot business was going to be eliminated in the way it was done. I think it was one of the few times that the commission had ever actually terminated an activity on Wall Street that was a significant part of the business of the street.
Did you recommend that the odd lots be terminated?
Pretty much. I don't remember what the exact language was, but it was pretty pretty clear by setting out the essentially the Abasco report. There was really nothing left to say. We met with the antitrust division when the Justice Department, when the study was completed. They wanted to go over all of our recommendations to see if there were any antitrust implications that they should be concerned about. And we came to the lot dealers. One of them simply said, well, who's going to take care of that, you or us? And we just went on to something else. Yeah. It's absolutely clear that was going to come to an end.
Well, speaking of getting rid of things, is it correct that you recommended that floor trading be...
That's a much more complicated matter. The traditional view at the commission among the staff, going all the way back, is that floor trading served no useful purpose. It was really a species of kind of insider trading situation, because the geography being at the time and place, floor traders could see trends of the market in particular stocks that the public wasn't privy to and make an eighth, a quick quarter, eighth, etc., which what they made, zero-sum game. What they made, the public wasn't. Some member of the public wasn't making. As a matter of fact, as I said earlier, the special study was a wonderful time for frustrated academics. We had subpoena power and had time to read and reflect, etc. And I found out that the pejorative use of the word chiseling, came from the exchange and was floor traders who could chisel between the bid and the offer. And make some money by coming between the bid is 40 and the offer is 41. They come in 48 and an eighth and thump at 40 and 7/8. So they were called chiselers. And that's how the pejorative of chiseling came about. We found that there were two, aside from this sort of species of insider trading that one might say, the problems broke down into two sort of discernible groups of floor traders. There were any member of the exchange, if he wasn't otherwise occupied, could wander over to a post, see where the action was, and get, let's say, in between the bid and the offer. Mm-hmm. One of the specialists we had on the record described them as the basketball players, because they always seem to be able to reach in and get between everybody else. There were others who dealt in large blocks of securities. They were not specialists, but they bought large blocks. There was a growing institutional business on the exchange, which was one of the big contributions of the special study, the first study of the institutionalization of the markets took place within the special study. And the argument was that these fellows served a useful purpose. In any event, we, the staff, was not persuaded by that argument.
Did you try to test it and see if it made sense?
It was difficult. Wasn't enough of it to be able to use the same kind of testing that we did with specialist position taking, because they weren't doing this on a consistent basis. They may take a position and then some institutional buyer would want to come along and they would sell. And of course, I mean, the trick to making money is buying low and selling high. I mean, that's it. So they could do well while doing good. That's what the argument was. I think that the recommendation of the study was not a clear-cut recommendation. It did talk in terms of abolition. It also talked in terms of removing the excesses of floor trading. I haven't looked at it in a number of years. However, it became clear to me that there was not a majority on the commission who was willing to take the plunge and abolish floor trading and approve to be the issue that the exchange decided to dig in their heels and fight. How and why, I don't know, but it was the issue that they decided to do or die. And we were prepared. Now I'm going to the implementation phase of the study. After the study was completed, we discovered that consultants that the exchange had retained, Cressip McCormick and Paget, I think, was something like that, who the exchange had represented were going to do an independent study, that the exchange management was trying to dictate the results of that independent study. A man by the name of Jim Dowd, who was a professional working on that study, was deeply disturbed, came to the SEC and told us about it, and I think resigned from the firm.
Before we head completely into the implementation phase, there's one more subject that you dealt with that becomes very important, which is commission rates. Was there any thought to unfixing commission rates at this point?
No. At the beginning of the study, and this has to do with what I mentioned a moment ago, the institutionalization of the market, it was as clear as crystal from the very beginning that the commission rate, which was applied on a round lot basis, so if you bought 10 round lots, your commission was 10 times the size you bought one round lot. If you bought 1,000 round lots, your commission was 1,000 times. That was wildly unfair structure when you dealt with institutions. So we started with the view of examining that problem and probably coming to a solution which would call for a steep volume discount.
Okay.
This is what first got me into the mutual fund area. Because as we investigated how the commission rates worked, it struck me as very strange that institutions and particularly mutual funds, although a small segment. Struck me as strange that mutual funds, although a small segment of the institutional market in terms of assets at that time, nevertheless a much more important segment because it traded. Mutual funds traded a lot more than bank trusts traded, who usually lived on a buy and hold forever strategy when they bought equities at all. It struck me as very strange that the mutual funds, that the files did not show any activity. Hi, okay, can go off the record for a second?
Sure. Oh.
This is my wife, Ann Schwartz. Again, it struck me as very, very strange and odd that the files of the exchange, the press, the periodicals, contained absolutely nothing from mutual funds pointing to the fact that the commission rates they were paying were wildly excessive. And so we looked into what was first was sort of an interesting byway, and we discovered the entire give-up situation, which takes a little explaining. While the exchange commission rate schedule had an anti-rebate rule, so you could not rebate any portion of your commissions, death penalty, to rebate commissions to customers, it was perfectly appropriate for a customer to direct, and with the agreement of their broker, for a customer to direct the broker, the exchange member broker, to split the commission with another exchange member. Now, allegedly, supposedly, historically, this got started when your, as they used to call them in the old days, your customer's man, broker, would go on a vacation to Europe, and you had to give your personal order to a colleague of his. As a courtesy, you would direct a split of the commission to your broker who was on vacation because of the wonderful service that he had provided to you over the years. That was supposedly the genesis of give-ups. What it was being used for by large segments of the mutual fund industry was to supplement sales compensation for the sale of mutual fund shares by member firms who did not execute the portfolio orders of the mutual fund. Now, the mutual fund would go, the traders for the mutual fund knew who they wanted to execute orders. They would go to four people with a particular skill and ability that they liked. But it could well be that firm really didn't have retail capacity and weren't selling mutual fund shares to the public. But some other firms were. And so you would direct the executing firm to split the commission with the people who were selling your shares of your mutual fund to the public. This answered the question to us why the fund industry wasn't pressuring the exchange to reduce the commission, because they were using portions of the commission to subsidize further the sales charges being charged for mutual funds.
So this came up in the special study.
Oh, yes. And it then, in an epiphany, I think one of these things that several of us at the same time, you never know exactly who, realized that we could get a handle on the excess over the cost of execution by how much the executing firms would be willing to give up to other firms at the direction of a customer. So in other words, we found that within the umbrella of the minimum commission rate schedule, there was a lively free market operating, and that the mutual funds were pushing the executing brokers to give up large portions to the people selling their shares. And so that in studying commission rates, which actually had to be left to another day in the sense that the study, the special study, didn't have the time or the resources to do a cost analysis of expenses, profitability of member firms, it struck us that we had stumbled on a tremendous shortcut to a cost analysis, because we could now demonstrate what the free market would charge for pure execution of mutual fund orders, and that this would be free of all of the years of argumentation that you would get into with the exchange and cost studies done by them and cost studies done by consultants and third parties and the commission, which would be a fertile ground for employment by economists and accountants for a decade. That here we had an actual demonstration of what the approximate cost of execution actually were. Now let me switch to the implementation phase for a moment on this. We continued to study the operation of the commission rate schedule as part of the implementation, and followed the money, as it was. And discovered along the way that practices on the regional exchanges differed somewhat from the New York Stock Exchange. Now, one of the problems, in parenthesis, that the fund industry seemed to have is that while the New York Stock Exchange was quite happy with a situation where commission dollars could be split, but as long as they stayed within the New York Stock Exchange community, this left the fund industry with no ability to give extra rewards to non-members of the New York Stock Exchange, so-called NASD-only brokers. And at that time, the small brokers, non-members of the New York Stock Exchange, were actually the backbone of mutual fund share distribution. And so the managers of the mutual funds were quite unhappy that the exchange, New York Stock Exchange, prohibited a split of commissions with non-members. Well, it's part of the genius of American entrepreneurship that somebody else thought of a way of doing this, but at the same time ended up bringing down the temple in the process. And that was the Detroit Stock Exchange. Now, nobody would really dream that you could get institutional size executions of orders on the Detroit Stock Exchange. So if you wanted to, for whatever reason, to have an order executed on the Detroit Stock Exchange or any other regional exchange, I'm talking about a large institutional order, the execution had to be put together in New York, essentially, on the New York Stock Exchange. So now you had Fund X selling to Institution B 20,000 shares of IBM. And in fact, they negotiated a price. And that price could be a purely negotiated price or a price off the exchanged ticker for IBM, depending on the negotiation, an eighth of a point one way or a quarter of a point the other way. Then you could call the member that put together the trade on the New York Stock Exchange was likely to be a dual member of not only the New York Stock Exchange, but most or all of the regional exchanges. So that member could call his floor member on the Detroit Stock Exchange and say, I have 50,000 shares for execution at X and X price, executed at the next New York Stock Exchange print, a quarter off one way or the other, and bango, there's an exchange. Now the execution that order has taken place on the Detroit Stock Exchange. Now, the killer was that the Detroit Stock Exchange wanted to be very helpful and attracting business to the exchange, adopted a rule that you could split your commission. 60% had to stay within the umbrella of the Detroit Stock Exchange membership. 40% could be given to any NASD member around the country. And that's what ultimately brought the temple down. Because this meant that if you could direct a give up to a member, a non-member of an exchange, every mutual fund organization has an underwriter, part of the same corporate family as the investment advisor, mm-hmm. in 99.9% of the cases, has an underwriter who's a member of the NASD. You could then direct the give up back to the fund's underwriter and therefore offset part of your advisory fee that you're charging fund investors against the receipt of the give-up off the Detroit Stock Exchange. This then led to famous or infamous, depending upon which side you were on, the case Moses against Bergen, the suit against Fidelity, which held that Fidelity had violated its fiduciary duty by not seeking to recapture brokerage on behalf of its fund shareholders, but were rather using it to promote sales. So when I say it was the Detroit Stock Exchange that brought the temple down, that's what I meant, because now it broke the alignment between the fund industry and the brokerage community in New York. And it was no longer a system in which everybody profited except the customers of the fund shareholders. And probably, I put it aside somewhere.
About when would this have been?
Well, I can give it to you exactly. Okay. Probably the most important single document I've ever written in my career was a one-page document. This is during the implementation phase when I was asked by a division of corporate regulation my views on a pending registration statement they had from a mutual fund organization, which said that it was impossible for them to recapture brokerage on behalf of fund shareholders. And I sent back a one-page memorandum saying it was possible and the registration statement as drafted was inaccurate. And I said that broke the alignment between the fund industry and the exchange, and it was sort of all downhill after that. Gene Rotberg then picked up, and Walter Werner picked up the investigation, which went on and really made public, essentially, all of the stuff we're now talking about.
That's the investigation that was finished up in 66?
Yeah, and led to May Day, or whatever they called it.